This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking about the Education Justice Project with its director, Professor Rebecca Ginsberg. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you in the studio. For many listeners who may not know about the Education Justice Project, tell us a little bit of its history and what you do.
The Education Justice Project offers educational programs to men who are incarcerated at Danville Correctional Center, which is a men's state prison about 35 miles east of Urbana-Champaign, near the border with Indiana. The core of our program is four-credit University of Illinois courses, upper division 300 and 400-level courses, which we offer on a semester basis. And we offer a range of extracurricular activities, from writing workshops to a theater program. We have a guest lecture series. The students put out a newsletter, and many more other initiatives.
I saw from your website that there's going to be a Shakespeare play, The Tempest, coming up.
It's our second theater production. Can I tell you about how that started?
Oh, please.
So one of the four-credit classes that we offered in the fall of 2011 was a play entitled Shakespeare's class entitled Shakespeare's Worlds, which was taught by University of Illinois history professor and theater professor Carol Symes. As part of the course, she required the students to memorize scenes from Shakespeare and to present them to the class.
Oh.
Although the majority of the class was about the history of Shakespeare and the history of theatrical production in that era in England. Well, the students loved the performance aspect. And at the end of the semester, they told her they didn't want to stop, which is, as you'll hear, typical of our students who have boundless energy and enthusiasm to learn. So she agreed, and we're very grateful to her for agreeing, to continue working with the students and to mount a production of Shakespeare. Select scenes from various plays, which she and the students produced and put on in January of 2012. And that was such a success. We had two different showings and were able to invite people, members of the public, to the prison to view the showings. It went over very, very well. And in fact, if people are interested in seeing some of that, they can go to our website, www.educationjustice.net. And they can see some of the video from our play, which is what we called it. The initiative was then formalized as a new Education Justice Project program called the Theater Initiative. And as you say, Steve, they're currently working on a production of The Tempest, which will be hosted at the prison at Danville on April 3rd and April 17th. And again, we'll be bringing out members of the public and members of the prison community to watch the show.
So people, listeners who are interested, can actually get tickets to go or not?
They can try. At this point, I think we're pretty booked.
Are you?
But okay. I would certainly encourage anybody who is listening who would like to try to get in a seat or wants to be first with next year's production to contact us through the Education Justice Project website.
And again, that's educationjustice.net. And for folks who don't have access to computers, there's a phone number they can call you. Is that right?
Yeah, they can call
244-3344.
That's the best number to call, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5.
Okay. Tell us about how you got involved in this. Here you are with a PhD from Berkeley. You have a law degree from Michigan. You're associate professor in education policy organization and leadership department here at the university. You have a dual appointment also in landscape architecture. Why this?
Well, I should say that when I came to the University of Illinois 9 years ago, I did not have a dual appointment in the College of Education. That's come about through my directorship of the Education Justice Project. But I did come here from University of California at Berkeley, very determined to teach in a prison. And I wanted to do that because I'd had the experience as a graduate student in Berkeley teaching through a well-established, very well-respected prison education program that puts on classes at San Quentin for the men incarcerated at San Quentin Prison. And for folks interested, the name of that program is the Prison University Project. They've also got a wonderful website. In fact, when I interviewed with my then department head in the Department of Landscape Architecture, I said, "Where's the closest prison?" And I'll tell you why I'm asking. It's because I want to teach there. And he was very supportive of that. And so I, after being here for about a year and having discovered that there were no established programs that allowed faculty or graduate students to teach at any of the local, at any of the regional prisons, started to work by getting together a small group of people who had similar interests. Many of us had also taught previously at prisons across the country, women's prisons and men's prisons. And our goal was to establish such a program at the University of Illinois. Now, Steve, it took us 2 years.
To do that.
It took two years from 2006 to 2008 to establish the program. And along the way, we identified friends and allies in this work. We visited programs from across the country, in California, New York, successful programs. We talked to students, incarcerated students in those programs about what they liked about those programs and asked them to give us advice if in establishing a program like that in Illinois, what should we be mindful of? What would they, what for, in their eyes, what would an ideal program look like? We brought it all back to Urbana-Champaign. We engaged in many months of serious program design, and we launched our first classes at Danville Prison in the fall of 2008. Those were actually two not-for-credit reading groups, a reading group in history and a reading group in psychology, to introduce us to the students, to introduce the students to us, and get the systems in place before we started with the four-credit classes in the spring of 2009. So we're currently celebrating our, or about to round out our fifth year of academic offerings at the prison. And it's been an incredibly wonderful 5 years. The students at Danville Prison have surpassed our expectations in terms of their intellectual vigor and rigor, their dedication to hard work, and their commitment to the program. They're very serious students. They're very, they don't attend classes because they get any time off their sentences, because they don't get any perks for participating in the program. They attend and they become involved in efforts to help organize and plan activities around the Education Justice Project, because it means so much to them to get a higher education for their sakes, for the sakes of their family members, and for the sakes of their communities in the prison and back at home.
Tell us some of the classes that are off, that have been offered over the last 5 years at the Danville Correctional Center.
Okay. I'll tell you about some of the four-credit classes, and then I also want to tell you about more of the extracurricular activities, because indeed many of our students say that they find the extracurricular activities as or more exciting than the four-credit classes.
Oh, just like real college.
Well, you know, we refer to Danville as the Danville campus of the University of Illinois, and I certainly treat it as such, and our students treat it as such as well. Let me tell you about the five classes we're offering this semester, and I hope I can remember them. We're offering a class in robotic engineering taught by Tim Vredel in aeronautic engineering. We're teaching a class on the history of American theater from 1945 until the present, taught by Diana Jayer. That class is being taught through the Department of English. I have to say, the Department of English has been a real friend to the Education Justice Project from the beginning. We're teaching a class in anthropology. It's our first anthropology class at Danville Prison, and we're very excited because I think our students, I think all students, all people are natural anthropologists. So finding the terms and methodologies,
exactly. From? How do we live?
What does that mean? What do I make of the way that this room is organized, of that ritual, of that habit, of that custom? That course is being taught through, again, the Department of Anthropology by David Schrag, and we hope it will be the first of many anthropology courses. We're offering a course through communication, and again, communications has been a really supportive friend of the Education Justice Project, by Peter Campbell, who's just about to be graduated PhD in communication.
So some grad students have taught some of these courses.
Yeah. In order to teach a course with us, the same qualifications are necessary as would be necessary on the Urbana-Champaign campus. So just as on the Urbana-Champaign campus, occasionally advanced graduate students teach courses, advanced students teach courses with the Education Justice Project as well.
And often with their enthusiasm, they're some of the best courses.
Absolutely. Yeah. And because they're right on top of the literature as well. And let me tell you about the fifth course, which is Rob Scott's course in education policy. And that's taught through my home department, Education Policy Organization and Leadership. I want to say something about that department, EPOL, Education Policy Organization and Leadership, because they offer Education Justice Project, its current home. When the program started, we were a unit of the Center on Democracy in a multiracial society. And they offered us a place to start, to begin to develop the program. They helped us with fundraising to house our funds. And then we moved to EPOL, which has turned out to be a really wonderful home for us. It's fitting, I think, that we're part of the College of Education. And I'm really happy for the opportunity to say on the air how happy and grateful we are to the College of Education, because it's been a wonderful fit with a very supportive dean, Mary Kalantzis, in the College of Education. Jim Anderson is the head of EPOL, who welcomed Education Justice Project with open arms to EPOL in 2011. So that's our new base, and Rob Scott is teaching a class through that department for us currently.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Rebecca Ginsburg, who is the director of the Education Justice Project here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign that provides 4-credit courses at the Danville Correctional Center. If you'd like to join this conversation, we're eager to have you give us a call. You can join us by phone if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. 333-9455. If it's a long-distance call, there's a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We know, of course, we have many listeners who join us via the internet at will.illinois.edu/am, who are listening to this live or perhaps on a public radio app on many devices around the world, literally. You may use that 800 number if you're within the continental U.S. We can't take overseas calls, unfortunately, on that number. If you missed part of this program, you can always hear archives. It's often up very soon, but always in a week or two. And you can listen to this program at your convenience that way as well.
Steve, can I tell you about some of the extracurricular activities that we host at the prison? And I'm particularly interested to share, because we're currently accepting applications from people who are interested in teaching or tutoring or facilitating programs at the prison. You don't have to be affiliated with the University of Illinois to be involved with the Education Justice Project. Some of our members are community members who are committed to the impact of higher education in prison. So we have a tutoring program. In addition to the five four-credit classes that we're offering this semester, we provide our students the opportunity to receive tutoring and support 3 times a week, and we take applications for tutors. The qualification is seriousness of purpose, dedication to and commitment to prison higher education, and a baccalaureate degree. We have the theater initiative that I spoke of earlier, and we're looking for people with theater backgrounds who might be interested in getting involved in that work. We also have a program called FACE, which stands for Family and Community Engagement. One of the things we learned when we traveled around the country, to California and New York, speaking to people already involved in prison education programs, was repeatedly from students in these programs how much it meant to their family members on the outside that they were taking college classes in prison. And we heard them say things like, "My family has been ashamed of me all my life, and now they're proud of me. And my children weren't planning to go to college, but I said, if I can go to university in prison, then you can go to university on the outside, and the children went.
So this program not only has an immediate effect on the lives mm-hmm. of the prisoners who may, the people who are in prison who have a much better chance of not getting back in prison by getting this kind of education that perhaps will help them get gainful employment. It also affects their families and the next generation.
Absolutely. We talk about the ripple effects, of higher education in prison. And those effects, frankly, are pretty immediate as well. Through the FACE program, we have contact with family members and loved ones of the Education Justice Project students, most of whom live in Chicago. In the state of Illinois, most incarcerated men and women come from Chicago. In fact, most of them, well, a good proportion of them, come from one of seven neighborhoods in Chicago. That's how entrenched and systematized mass incarceration is right now, and how racialized it is.
Yes.
So we have regular events where we interact with our family members, with their family members in Chicago. In fact, I was in Chicago yesterday at a small planning meeting of family members of FACE students, of Education Justice Project students, and alumni of the Education Justice Project, planning the next open house that we're going to hold for family members in Chicago. So it's a very important program. I think that's one of the most important impacts of higher education in prison, and there are many impacts, is the impact on the generations. People who have family members who are incarcerated are more likely to go to prison, and people who have incarcerated parents are also more likely to have a host of other effects, such as dropping out of high school early, becoming involved in run-ins with the law, becoming involved with depression. So anything that we can do to reduce the stigma associated with incarceration and provide an example to our students of hope and of promise and of opportunity and to their family members, we count that as one of the successes of the Education Justice Project. So I was speaking earlier about applications. We're also accepting applications from people who are interested in working with us to develop networks and support systems and resource information for the family members based mostly in Chicago, but they're frankly across the world. We have students from around the world. We have men from around the world in Danville Prison. And people who are interested in learning more or in applying to work with the Education Justice Project should, again, go to the website www.educationjustice.net. And let me just add that I use the word work loosely. And you're smiling because you know what I'm going to say is that everybody is volunteer. We've got dozens of instructors, tutors, the guest speakers who come out to the prison to take part in our guest speaker series. I want to talk about our ESL, English as a Second Language program.
Did you have art programs I want to talk about?
Well, we don't actually have an art program.
Oh, you don't.
No, you know, we offer upper division university courses. There are other places within the prison, other units within the prison that offer art programs.
Well, I knew there was an exhibit at the university. Why?
That's right. I want to tell you about that because the way we got involved with that is quite exciting. We don't have an art program at the prison. We don't offer art classes. But we do have, among our students, some artists. More importantly, we have among our students people who are very interested in outreach. Some people have the idea that once a person is locked up, once a person is incarcerated, they're separated from the world. They're almost been thrown away. And we try hard to counter that impression. The students at the Education Justice Project are very committed to reaching out. So they organized the art exhibit. They put out the flyers around the prison asking for other men incarcerated at Danville Prison to submit art. When men responded to those calls, the students of the Education Justice Project organized and ran the meeting of the artists. They selected the work that would be displayed, and they wrote the essays that appeared in the exhibition catalog.
And it was a wonderful exhibition.
It was wonderful, and we plan to continue it.
We're about 20 minutes into our program, and we need to take a quick break. We'll get back to our guest, Rebecca Ginsberg, Director of the Education Justice Project here at the University of Illinois, in just a minute. But let's hear some information about what's coming up on Focus.
The American Heart Association says women who smoke are at a much higher risk for heart problems than previously thought. Ideas about how often to have a mammogram are changing. These and other women's health issues may impact you or your loved one. So I hope you'll join us on Monday's Focus when we welcome your questions for Suzanne Truppen, an obstetrician and gynecologist on the faculty of the University of Illinois College of Medicine. I'm Craig Cohen. Join the conversation Monday morning at 10 on listener-supported public radio, WILL AM 580.
And back with our guest on Keeping the Faith, Rebecca Ginsberg. Rebecca, you were talking about some of the benefits of this program to the people who are in prison, but also to their families, to the society in general. But there was a time when there were a lot of these programs in prison. Back in the early 90s, I read that there were like 700 programs in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But then this bill came from the federal government in 1994, called the Violent Crime and Law Enforcement Act, and it basically eliminated Pell Grants for prisons. Why? What happened?
You know, you're right that there's a long history of offering higher education to incarcerated men and women in the United States. And in fact, Illinois has pride of place in that history. Illinois was one of the first states in the country in this century to offer courses, and college-level courses have been available since 1956 in Illinois. Now, the 1994 Act, as you say, did make it not feasible for many universities and colleges around the country to continue to offer higher education to incarcerated men and women. We don't know exactly what the number is of those programs that existed beforehand. The data is really fuzzy, but it probably was close to 700. As I've also seen 300. That tells you how fuzzy those numbers are. But within 2 years of the bill coming out, most of the programs, this is much is very clear, most of the programs had folded. And that includes many of the programs here in Illinois. Roosevelt University held on. Roosevelt had been offering college degrees to men and women across the state for many, many years. And Roosevelt, when the Pell Grants were disallowed, stepped in with its own funds until 2010. And I take my hat off to Roosevelt University because it was very, very committed to higher education for incarcerated men and women. You know, you asked what happened. There's been a sea shift, right? And it's been coming. In a way, we're lucky that we were able to do this work until the mid-1990s because the sea shift dates even earlier to the 1970s. People looking at this talk about the shift from a focus in rehabilitation as the purpose served by incarcerating a man or a woman to a perspective where the purpose served by incarcerating somebody is to punish him or her, the punitive society. And we see signs of that in the late 1950s. It becomes much clearer in the 1960s. And by the 1970s, the tide has turned. And many jurists now don't even talk about the idea, the hope of rehabilitating somebody, of prison being a site for change. But I believe strongly, and the Education Justice Project believes strongly, that prison should be a place of hope, a place for change. And providing higher education within prisons is one of the ways that we can make that vision real. It's been well established that among programs, prison-based programs that seek to reduce recidivism, education is the most effective.
And where did the money finally come from here at the University of Illinois to start up this program again 5 years ago?
The money comes from three main sources. And they're all discretionary sources. I want to emphasize that. We are not on anybody's budget right now. There is nobody who has an obligation, no unit, no organization that has the Education Justice Project as part of its budget. All of the money that we receive is provided by people who, out of the goodness of their hearts, or because they're pragmatic and realize that it's a sound investment in a safe society are providing donations. And that's as true as of private individuals as it is of the University of Illinois donors. So we get three sources, University of Illinois, and at the University of Illinois, it's because we apply for grants and awards. And when we're lucky enough to win them, the Education Justice Project receives those funds. A second source is grants and foundations. And a third source are those private donations that I spoke about. We seek funds from donors across the country. And in fact, many of our students at Danville Prison donate out of their meager salaries towards their education. Many of the family members of our students at Danville as well donate to the Education Justice Project. Can I just say something about our budget, though? Because I want to emphasize what an extraordinary bargain this is. We've talked about the ripple effects and about the fact that in educating an incarcerated man or woman, you touch not only the student, not only the incarcerated student, you not only fill him with hope and a sense of what is possible for him and renew and revigorate his expectations of what he's going to be able to achieve both in the prison and outside of the prison in ways that are quite profound. And I hope I'll have the opportunity to share some stories. But you touch as well his cellmate, the person who sleeps with him, who shares a cell with him at the prison, who may not be ready to enter the University of Illinois, may not be ready to enter the community college program that's at the prison, but hears his stories about what it means to be sitting in a class and to learn and to have one's world open up. It touches his family members, and it touches, frankly, the cellmate's family members. It touches the person he talks to in line on the way to the cafeteria. And, of course, it touches all of society because, as I've said, if we're going to have lower recidivism numbers, that impacts us not only because we're going to be paying less to incarcerate people, but the reason recidivism numbers really matter is because behind each instance of rearrest or reincarceration, there's a harm that's taken place. Somebody has been hurt. So the cost to society is very significant because less people are going to be hurt. There's going to be less violence out there. And we have accomplished all that, educating about 120 men last year, and our budget was $39,000. That's extraordinary. I can't think of another program, another way of investing $39,000 that would have begun to reap those impacts.
Now, that $39,000 pays for what?
It pays primarily for books and educational materials, course packs. We also have a library at the prison. Now, the prison, by law, has its own library. It's a law library, and it works well for those purposes. But for our students who are upper division, non-degree students at the University of Illinois at Danville, they need it more. So we have a library at the prison with about 2,000 volumes right now.
Do some of those come from the program Books for Prisoners?
No. In fact, we make a point of not taking books from Books to Prisoners. You know, I'll tell you why. Books to Prisoners, which is a wonderful program and very supportive of Books to Prisoners, and I hope your listeners will remember when they see those boxes at places like the co-op to put their books inside. Books to Prisoners reaches men and women in prisons throughout the state, in corners of the state where there aren't otherwise resources and local people who are willing to go in. Our students at Danville are lucky. They've got us. They've got dozens of volunteers from the University of Illinois and the community who go back and forth Monday through Friday every week. I would rather see the books that are donated to Books to Prisoners go to the men and women incarcerated in those lonely corners of the state. They need them.
Sure.
Our students, my goodness, one of the main sources of book donations is publishers' donations to faculty members.
Sure.
That faculty members might otherwise end up recycling, for example. And all faculty members and all graduate students, as you probably know, have moaning bookshelves, overfull bookshelves, and we get a lot of book donations that way. Yeah. And you were asking me about our finances. We will spend money on acquiring books for the library as well.
And for the specific classes you're offering.
Mm-hmm. We also seek publishers' donations. We never turn down an opportunity to ask for support.
Sure.
And once a professor provides us with his or her book list for the coming semester, our course coordinator, that's currently Maggie Kanalainen, will go to book publishers and ask them if they'll donate. And we have a pretty good hit rate, pretty good success rate getting either free books or donations of books from publishers. Another high cost in our budget is printing. We print a newsletter that's wonderful. It's designed by a woman named Eileen Lagman, who's a PhD student in English here at the university. It's very effective both in raising funds for us, but as or perhaps even more importantly, in getting the word out about the value of prison higher education. And of course, it's not just about prison higher education. It's about the carceral society more generally. It's about shifting the focus from being a punitive society, a society that thinks of incarcerated men and women as people, as I said earlier, who we should throw away, who have broken the rules and are now no longer fit to be part of us, to shifting of prison as a therapeutic institution. Prison as a place where people can go, should go, must go, if they have violated certain rules, to get their act together. And that we support them in that process. We support them in the process of their becoming the best man or woman that they can be, in developing into their best selves through education and also through other programs, religious programs, recovery programs, anger management, counseling, and so on.
You refer to the people in prison as incarcerated men and women. There's a problem you were telling me with folks like myself who have referred to them as prisoners. tell us a little bit about how important language can be.
Mm, thank you for bringing that up. It's very generous of you, because before we went on the air, I told you that I wanted to bring up this subject. And I want to invite your listeners to Google this. It's called An Open Letter to Our Friends. An Open Letter to Our Friends. When I Googled it earlier today, I found it was the third thing that appeared. An Open Letter to Our Friends is from a policy group based in New York that's made of people formerly incarcerated. And in this letter, they ask that we please be mindful of our language when speaking about people who have spent time in prison or in jail. They tell us about the sorts of language, the sorts of terms that are sometimes applied to them. Inmates, convicts, predators, offenders, animals even, felons. And it says in this letter, I'm quoting from the letter now, all of these terms are devoid of humanness, and they identify us as things rather than as people. They go on in the letter to ask that when we, their allies, speak of people who have been incarcerated, we please refer to them as people who have been incarcerated. People on parole, people recently released from prison, people with criminal convictions. But the main word there is people. People. Language is powerful, and it speaks to at least two important points. The first is how the public conceives of people who have been incarcerated, and the degree of openness and compassion and trust that they will extend to people when they seek, for example, employment or housing. And I think we're more likely to exercise that compassion and that openness and that trust when we are predisposed through our language to see them as people.
Let me give the phone numbers one more time for listeners who might like to join this conversation with Rebecca Ginsburg, director of the Education Justice Project. 333-9455, that's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If you're in the 217 area code around Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, if you're listening long distance or online, you may use a toll-free number, 1-800-222-WILL, 222-9455.
Can I tell you about the second reason that language matters is not because of what people like you or me think about people in prison or people formerly in prison. It's because of what language might do to the way people themselves in prison or formerly in prison think of themselves.
Sure.
Because it's such a powerful thing. And if we can provide the language to help people who are placed in prison, formerly in prison, on parole, as people so situated, rather than any of those other things, they're more likely to think of themselves as deserving, as being part of our society, as welcomed by us. I see the lights are flashing, so
really,
let me cut it
really,
down.
Really affects their self-concept.
As it would for the language that
any
people use to affect,
sure.
to apply to any of us, affects our self-concept
sure.
and our self-respect.
And we do have a caller waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Rebecca Ginsburg. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm curious as to the number of people who are incarcerated in the Danville prison. I'm curious how many of those people are in your program, and I'm wondering how a person applies to get into your program. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll tell you that the prison was built to house 925 people, and that it currently holds about 1,800, because that will give you an idea of the growth of the prison population in Illinois and across the country in recent decades. It was built in 1985. So of a population of about 1,800, we have about 120 men who are involved with the Education Justice Project. And let me break that down for you a little bit, because it gets to the second question. We have about 75 men who are enrolled in University of Illinois upper division courses. In order to be in those courses, they have to have 60 credit hours of lower division, 1 in 200 level, academic credit hours, just as they would on the traditional campus in order to take upper division courses or to apply to U of I as an upper division transfer student. You need 60 credit hours. That's the only requirement we have. We don't have any other restrictions. For example, we don't restrict based on the student's age, which some prison education programs do. We don't restrict based on the nature of the offense for which he has been incarcerated. If you have those 60 credit hours of lower division work, then you are welcome to enroll in a University of Illinois course at the Education Justice Project. And that's because we think prison should be a place of hope, a place for change, and not a punitive place. Now, the difference between 75 and 40 has to do with our English as a Second Language program, which I told you I hoped I'd have a minute to talk about. Our ESL program is called Language Partners. And Language Partners is a program I'm very proud of because it was developed and initiated by EJP students. Ramon Cabrales is actually the EJP student, the Education Justice Project student, who developed the idea as part of a course taught by a professor, Patrick Berry, in which he proposed that given the number of monolingual Spanish-speaking men at Danville Prison, men who were shut out from prison society because they couldn't speak English, they couldn't get jobs within the prison system, they may not even be able to speak to their cellmate or to the nurse or the doctor if they had a health concern. You're shaking your head. And I understand it's really profound to think of how debilitating it is to be stuck in a prison and not able to speak the language. It's like a nightmare. But he reckoned there are between 1 and 200 men in that situation. He also reckoned that he and other University of Illinois students at the prison, Education Justice Project students, who were bilingual, fluent in Spanish and English, and smart, competent, and capable, could provide ESL instruction to these men. And he proposed that idea, and I thought it was brilliant. I would never have come up with that idea on my own because I didn't know what the needs were within that prison. We all thought it was a brilliant idea. We developed it. We sought funding support. The Mary Jane Stevic Foundation here in town was generous enough to give us support for this program. And we were able to find people within the university who offered training to our students to become peer ESL instructors. We sent out flyers. The students, again, drew up flyers and sent them around the prison asking men who are interested in taking ESL programs at the prison to come to a particular meeting. We were surprised. About 50 or 60 men showed up at that meeting. We could only take 10 of them.
Oh.
So we took 10. we call them the learning partners, and the others we didn't want to forget because they were crying for support as well. They're crying out. And why did they want to learn English? Not only because English is the language of the prison, but increasingly, the longer they spend in prison, English is the language of their families on the outside. And in some cases, our students have children and grandchildren living in the United States who are growing up speaking English, and their dad or grandfather is in prison speaking only Spanish. And you can imagine what it did for the family relation, for what a loss it was both for the incarcerated man, but what a loss it was for his family as well. So our students tell us now about how valuable, how important it is, and how meaningful it is for them to be able to read a letter from their grandchildren, from their nieces and nephews, and to be able to write to them in English. So all of the men involved with the ESL program are not strictly speaking EJP students, although I like to think of them that way. They're not U of I students, but they're getting instruction from the Education Justice Project. The ones who are not in the program, there are about 40 of them, we call for occasional ESL workshops. The students, the Education Justice Project students, conduct the workshops. They do the teaching. And it's, like I say, one of the programs I'm most proud of because it shows our students as leaders and activists within the prison community.
We're about 20 minutes left in our program with Rebecca Ginsburg from the Education Justice Project here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. Let me let listeners know what's coming up the next week or two. Next week, we're doing a program that was pre-recorded in order to take advantage of a visit to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, by the Orthodox Christian bishop for this area, Demetrius. And Professor Don Nolan from Parkland College did that interview with the bishop. And the discussion that they had is fascinating about the current restrictions that there are in the country of Turkey on the Orthodox patriarch there by the government. It's a very interesting discussion, and although you won't be able to call in and ask questions or comments, it's a very interesting interview to hear. We'll be broadcasting that next week, February 24, and that's here on Keeping the Faith. On the following week, we'll have a live program, a phone interview with someone in Alaska, a very interesting woman named Leslie Leland Fields. She's a published author, she's a very popular blogger, and she's a wonderful chef and often writes about food. She's very much concerned about the environmental impact of global warming that is showing up very quickly in the region she lives in Alaska. But she's primarily going to talk to us about her writer's life and writing about some of those topics. That'll be March 3rd here on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs, so we're always eager to have other people ask questions besides me. And you may do that at 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana area or long distance, 1-800-222-9455.
Steve, I just wanted to remind listeners that if they're interested in getting involved in our work or finding out more about the Education Justice Project's educational programs at Danville Correctional Center, they can go to our website, www.educationjustice.net. Applications to work with the Education Justice Project in the fall of 2013 are due on March 1st.
And if people need to use a phone to contact you, they can do that at 217-244-3344, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5.
Thank you.
And if you want to send an email, you can do that at info@educationjustice.net.
Thank you.
Rebecca, when you were back in Berkeley working on your PhD, and you've had a book published since then on one of your special interests on apartheid, did you ever imagine you'd be doing this kind of work?
I didn't imagine this in particular, but I'm not surprised to find myself here.
Did you have any family experience with people who were incarcerated?
I appreciate that question because it brings many people to this kind of work, the personal acquaintance with how difficult it is, if you are a family member of an incarcerated person, to negotiate that. It can be a shame. It can be a stigma. Often people feel reluctant to share with others that one of their family members is in prison and will say things like he or she is in the military or they're in the Peace Corps. That's one reason I so value the FACE program, because we hope that it allows some relief from that from any sense of embarrassment or any sense of shame. We hope ultimately it will be a form of empowerment for family members of incarcerated people. And we would love to see the family members and the loved ones who are involved with FACE use the platform of FACE to energize around issues that are particularly pertinent to family members of incarcerated people, like issue of the phone calls in and out of prison and the companies that control for those phone calls and charging exorbitant rates, for example. Another issue that is relevant to those family members is play areas, play-friendly spaces within the prison. Often families will take young children to visit a father or mother or a family member in prison, and there won't be a suitable place for children to wait and to, and so that it becomes a horrific rather than a pleasant thing for the child to visit that incarcerated family member. Well, if that's the case, the child is not likely to want to go back very often. So I would love to see FACE advocating for things ultimately like family-friendly sites within the prison to support family visits, supporting, in the long run, family cohesion. Prison doesn't have to necessitate a break. Sometimes it does. And we find that our students do better, and that the research certainly shows that all incarcerated men and women do better if ties with family members are maintained. Personally, I don't have a personal connection to incarceration.
Is you mentioned before the program began to me in our conversation that you are a regular at the Friends meeting, that you're a Quaker by your own personal religious affiliation. Has that motivated you in any way to do this kind of work?
Oh, sure. Not only am I a Quaker, but my parents met at a Quaker meeting. My parents met at the 57th Street meeting in Chicago. They were married at the 57th Street meeting in Chicago. So I grew up in a household where matters of justice and equity were commonly spoken about, and it was understood that we were going to apply our efforts and our energies to make the world a better place. You asked earlier if I was surprised when I found if I would be surprised to find myself now directing the Education Justice Project, involved with work to bring higher education to people incarcerated at Danville Prison. No, not surprised, but certainly, as you know, I attended law school. I've had a longstanding interest in matters of justice. I'm very interested in, I'm curious about how we at this particular moment when we seem to be struggling so much with incarceration as a people, the American people. I think that programs like the Education Justice Project and the people involved in those programs, the people who have been touched by those programs, can lend their voices and help shape the conversation so that we might see prisons become, in the future, more institutions that offer hope, institutions that are places for change than we currently do. And when I say people who have been touched by programs like the Education Justice Project lending their voices, I don't just mean the faculty members at the University of Illinois, and I don't just mean the graduate students at the University of Illinois. I mean, most pointedly, the students of the Education Justice Project. I would love to see them continue to act as they have, as leaders, as people with voices of authority who are capable and competent to speak on these social issues. I'd love to see them getting even more involved in the debate. On that note, I want to talk about Education Justice Radio, which is our new radio program at, I don't think you consider it a competitor.
WRFU?
WRFU, thank you. 104.5, Sundays from 2 to 3. This is a new program of the Education Justice Project, and it allows us to reach a greater audience and to discuss issues like the ones you and I have been talking about today, higher education, incarceration, criminal justice, the systemic nature of some of the more unsavory aspects of incarceration in our society, like its highly racialized nature. The impacts of incarceration upon family members, because these are people that we might encounter in our daily lives. And there are things that we can do to make it easier for them to carry the burden of incarceration. So Education Justice Radio, 2 to 3 on Sundays, is going to be an important forum for us, for our students, for friends and allies to address and ourselves become more educated through that engagement with others about these issues.
Let me give you a moment to clear your throat, and I'll make an announcement about some programs coming up at the University YMCA. A longtime sponsor of Keeping the Faith, the University Y is the oldest student organization on campus, founded back in 1873. So you can figure that out. They're celebrating their 140th anniversary here on this campus this year. Friday Forum has been going on for over 80 years at the University Y, and this semester they're focusing on faith in action. Coming up this coming Friday, February 22nd, Kim Bobo, who is the founder and executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice, will be presenting at noon at the University Y on the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street, right across from the newly refurbished Lincoln Hall. If you haven't seen that, you can do that when you visit campus. She'll be talking about advocating at the intersection of faith and labor. She's a wonderful speaker. That's February 22nd. The following week, March 1st, a guest who, like Kim Bobo, has been on Keeping the Faith, Reverend Alexander Sharp, who is currently the interim director at the Community Renewal Society in Chicago, will talk about, among other things, reforming drug policy in Illinois. Those are some of the things coming up at the University YMCA, Friday noons. You can order lunch in advance if you want to call 337-1500 or simply take a bag lunch or go and just listen to the wonderful lectures and have a chance to ask questions. I see we have another caller waiting on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Rebecca Ginsburg. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm in under the wire, I hope. I just wondered, when you spoke of the Spanish-speaking need for tutors, do you, or one-on-one friends, have you approached the unit on campus that does teacher training in that area? Are they aware of education justice? I wonder. They're in the Department of Linguistics now, but there are a lot of young folks there who I don't know whether they would be able to get over to Danville, but there is a bus, a shuttle, I believe. And I just wondered if you'd been in touch with that unit on campus at all.
Thank you for the question.
Yes, we have. In fact, the head of the Language Partners Program is a faculty member in linguistics. His name is Hugh Bishop. And incidentally, he was just named the Danville Correctional Center Volunteer of the Year because of the many, many hours he puts into Language Partners. Hugh heads the program, and many of his students are involved as facilitators in the Language Partners program. She also raised, the caller, a good question, and I want to point out that lack of transportation shouldn't deter anybody from getting involved with the Education Justice Project. We regularly travel to Danville through carpool. It's partly because we're committed to a green world and partly because so many of the people that are involved with our program don't have cars. So we share. And please don't let the lack of a personal vehicle be an obstacle to expressing some interest or getting involved in our work.
And I know from a previous conversation with one of the guests I interviewed for this program about the Amish that Professor Danny Otto from Eastern Illinois University is one of your volunteers.
And his brother, Milt Otto, is also a tutor with the Education Justice Project. And Milt has also taught one of our workshops. I should mention that. We have a science workshop series and a science and an English, a writing workshop series and a math workshop series, as well as a business workshop series. And Milt Otto, Danny's brother, is one of the people who's been offering series of workshops in investing to our students.
We're down to our last minute and a half or so, Rebecca. But tell us about one person who's you particularly think of whose life was changed by this program.
I'd be happy to talk to you about...
anonymously, of course.
I won't talk about him anonymously at all because I want his name to be out here. His name is Israel Gonzalez. And he was a peer instructor in our Language Partners program, which is to say he was a man incarcerated at Danville Correctional Center who gave up his time, his energy, his efforts to provide peer ESL instruction to men in the general population, Spanish-speaking men, who wanted to learn English. And in the process, he learned how to teach. He became a teacher. He was incarcerated at 18. He spent about 15 years inside. And when he was released, he was deported to Mexico. When he found himself in Mexico, he had no particular job to go back to. He had no educational qualifications to rely on, but he had his experience teaching at Danville Prison. And he used that. His aunt in Mexico had some contacts within local schools, and Israel Gonzalez is now a high school teacher outside Mexico City in Mexico. Now, he's just one of many success stories. I think 4 years ago, 5 years ago, he would never have imagined himself a teacher. But we also have other students who are now full-time at University of Illinois Chicago, involved in their community through NAACP. And I'm pleased to announce that one of our earliest alumni, one of our the persons who got it released most recently, is now going on for his PhD at Northeastern University. So those are just a few of the success stories of men staying in, who have left us. I could tell even more success stories of students still at Danville Prison who are doing wonderful things with the education they're receiving.
Thank you very much. It's very inspiring to hear about this, and I want to encourage people who might have an interest to volunteer. You can do that by going to the website at educationjustice.net, by sending an email to info@educationjustice.net, or calling 217-244-3344. Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Rebecca Ginsburg, who's the director of this program. She's an associate professor at the University of Illinois in Education Policy, Organization, and Leadership, and also has an appointment in landscape architecture. Her PhD was from Berkeley. She has a law degree from University of Michigan and has been here on this campus for 9 years and helping get this program started and has functioned, as you've been hearing, as a great promoter of the program and telling of its many benefits. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for Keeping the Faith here on WILL AM 580. Heard also simultaneously at 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. Archive programs can be heard at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Support for WILL Radio comes from the Friends of WILL and from Friar Tuck Beverage, offering a selection of beer brewing and wine-making supplies for the casual hobbyist to the serious brewer. Friar Tuck is located on South Neal Street in the Savoy Plaza, Savoy.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion. Rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.